we like Justin. Justin can stay.
You're listening to the Still Queer as Folk podcast. Each week, we take down an episode of Showtime's Queer as Folk TV show to find out if it still holds up 17 years later. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
This is a special episode of the Still Queer as Folk podcast. We're going to talk about season two as a whole and some of our favorite and least favorite moments in the show.
We'll be back discussing season three in 2 weeks, and we look forward to seeing what happens with Justin and the Fiddler on the Roof. Sounds crazy, no?
You know. And as always, remember to subscribe and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, all the social media platforms in the world. So before we talk about what we loved and hated, I thought I would share some stats with you, Matt.
Okay.
So we are now the longest running Queer as Folk podcast.
Ba-ba!
We've done 42 episodes across two seasons. We've had just under 100,000 plays. Our most popular episode is number one, which is the premiere.
Really?
Over the weekend, you had suggested that we reissue that one. So I took a listen to it and oh my God, I hated my performance on that one.
I thought it wasn't that bad. Maybe that's why I suggested it.
I don't know if you remember, but we got together over dinner, talked about doing a podcast. Like 3 weeks later, we got together again and recorded one just to see if we could do it and see how it would go. And so it's like super echoey. The audio is kind of all over the place. There's kind of like a bad mix to it. And so I was a little perturbed that that's our best episode or most popular episode.
But it's our first episode, and perhaps our listeners now are excited to see how we've grown.
Yes. And that was almost a year ago. That was in early September that we recorded that one of 2017. The second most popular episode was episode 8, Love for Sale. That was the Man I Love episode where Michael starts dating again after running away from Ben and his HIV.
I don't know why
that one's second most popular, but it is. Maybe we just did a lot of extra social media on that one.
We pushed that one just a little farther.
Yeah. So while most of our listeners are in the U.S., we've been heard in 82 countries. Here are some of the surprising ones.
Okay.
We have two listeners in Zimbabwe.
Hey!
We have 8 in Israel, where the show aired with a slightly different title. It was called Proud as Can Be. And there's actually a Hebrew name for it, too. There's no way that I could pronounce that. So it translates to Proud as Can Be. We have 10 listeners in Egypt.
Okay.
And here's the big surprising one. There's 18 listeners in Iran. So hello, Iranian listeners. Thanks for tuning in.
And I'm hoping that with the recent decision in India, we will have more listeners there.
Canada and Australia are also pretty popular for us. Of course, the show was filmed in Toronto, and it's currently airing in sequence in Australia on the SBS Viceland Network. So hello to our Aussie friends. As you recall, Please Like Me was the Australian mm-hmm. show that we watched. We briefly talked about doing a podcast on that one. I also watch Bondi Beach Rescue all the time. It's just hunky real-life lifeguards running around saving people, mostly tourists.
I am into that.
Yeah, it's kind of like a real-life Baywatch.
Which, by the way, I watched that remake movie with The Rock and Zac Efron. And
oh, yeah.
You know what? I had a real dumb fun time. That's all I could have asked for it.
Oh, you got to check out Bondi Beach Rescue then. It's really good.
Done.
It's like 12 seasons. I'm like through 9 of them so far.
Jeez.
I think. Oh, it's great. So let's talk about Queer as Folk instead of Bondi Beach Rescue and Please Like Me. Please Like Me. That's a kind of an underrated show. I think we're going to revisit that one.
I feel like I should.
Yeah.
I think
you remember his name, the lead character?
I think that's what it was. I remember really liking the first season, and then I think I got distracted with something. And,
yeah.
It fell off my radar. But yeah, I'd be interested in bringing that back.
We might have been distracted by looking at the time.
Which I will be bringing up later on in this podcast.
Oh, can't wait. So let's first talk about something that we never really gave good treatment to, during the airing of our podcast, and that's this opening music and the visuals with it.
Yes, can we?
So we're about to launch season three, so we have to live through this intro for one more season. The last two seasons have a different intro, but for now we're stuck with Spunk by Green Buck. Apparently they never recorded another song because I couldn't find anything.
It would be called Spunk.
Yeah. I just don't understand this intro because it starts out like Laverne and Shirley.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
1, 2, 3, 4.
But then they're skipping along to the factory.
Haas and Pfeffer Incorporated. This song is terrible, though. I mean, what does it mean? You can't dance to it. It's not a dance song. There's really no beat to it.
And if there is any type of rhythm to it, it then like switches up on it. And you're like,
yeah,
I don't know what to do with this.
It's just this wild kaleidoscope of colors that I don't know what they're telling us. It was almost like somebody got a new graphics card and they wanted to really stretch it and see how well they can make a demo.
Because I think they're trying to do like a sort of rainbow of colors, but because it's gay, but because it swirls the way it does and it looks more like a tie-dye trippy mess more than anything.
Yeah.
And I don't know what to focus on. And like, I get the, you know, having the naked men dance up on each other and be very sexy and gyrating and all of that. Sure. And I was thinking about this. About how I'm pretty sure as a young teenager, whenever we managed to get maybe like a weekend free of Showtime, because my parents did have cable, but we always had HBO and not Showtime, that I think whenever we got a free weekend of it, it was like 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, I would try and sneak to see what the hell Chorus Folk was, and I would see this credit sequence and think it was like just the
That's
most
what
salacious,
the gay world is like.
This is the most salacious, like dirtiest, naughtiest thing I could have seen at like 13, 14. Little did I know.
There's this guy in the middle of it that he just like all of a sudden drops into water, almost like a poached egg. He just comes like bloop.
Let's talk about the pair of dancers where one clearly has an erection.
Well, it was a little erection if it...
Oh, no, that was not a little erection. That was huge.
I just thought that was a little bulge.
It looked like it was to the right, though. So I thought it was... That's where it was just tucked away.
We'll have to examine this closer. Yes.
Upon further inspection, listeners, let us know what you think.
This intro, it just didn't have anything to do with the show. I just don't get it.
Nothing to do with any of the characters. It doesn't show any of the characters.
Right.
Naked bodies. That's what it was.
Yeah, and it was just a wall of music. And even when the show originally aired, this music didn't make any sense. This was not the music of the late 1990s, early 2000s. This was just bizarre mashup type of thing. And for a show that put so much importance into the soundtrack and the score, this opening sequence was just a total biff. It gets a little better in season four, but even then it goes from like, what the fuck to why the fuck? It's just one of those kooky little openings with, I don't know, like soft focus and all the characters. Ben puts on a scarf. I remember that part.
Yes.
We've got like a whole season to watch before we talk about that though.
Yes. I would love to get further research into how this opening credit sequence was developed. If there was any meaning behind it. I want answers.
Does anybody know? Please tweet at us. Let's talk about some of our favorite scenes. So I have one, two, three. I would call these more arcs than scenes.
Sure.
So I'll tell you what my three are, and then we'll circle back. You can tell me what your three are, and then we'll talk about them, see if we have any overlap. Of course, my favorite arc is Justin.
Okay.
The runner-up was George and Emmett, and the second runner-up was Granny Faye. Do you remember Granny Faye?
Yes, I do.
So I kind of see this all as the season of Justin because, well, you tell me what yours are first.
So two of mine are the same as yours.
Granny Faye.
Granny Faye is one.
Really?
Yes. Do you think you could guess the other one?
Probably George and Emmett.
Yes.
Yeah.
I wanted to, my third one is specifically a scene rather than an arc.
Okay.
It is that editing that we have between Justin and Ethan in bed and Brian and Michael at Babylon.
Oh yeah.
The creation of that scene is just one of my favorite things in season two. And I do want to do, I have a fourth one. It's not season two. It's just a quick little shout out to something from season one. And it's Chris and Justin in the locker room.
Oh, when he gave him the handy?
When he gave him the handy.
Oh.
Because that is still insanely hot to watch.
Did I ever show you the UK version of that?
I have seen the UK version and it is, very tame compared to what they did.
Oh, you think so?
I think so. And even though, you know, Chris bashes Justin later on, it's still
good hand job.
A brilliant hand job. Like it is a,
it drove him insane. He went crazy and beat people up.
The orgasm caused him to go mentally insane.
So speaking of Justin, this is why I like the Justin arc. He started out the season as a drooling vegetable. He fucked a cute virgin. He went on his first parade with mom Jennifer. He secured Brian as his partner. He was a stripper, a cokehead, an inspiring art school pupil, gawked at dumpster boy being hauled away, became a comic book illustrator, fell for, romanced, and eventually ended the season leaving Babylon with a violin player. Now that's an arc.
All while still a teenager.
Yeah. Yeah, he turned 18 this season.
This kid just became eligible to vote and did all of that.
So I thought, like I said, this is the season of Justin. So that's why I gave him the winning nod in my favorite arc.
It's very much a season of him blossoming into being the gay man he believes he can be. Mm. And I think that's a very...
The gay teenager great, he can yes. be.
Well, and think about that. Think how many... It would be a little crazy to call him a role model, but gay teens who have characters they could look up to, who would be their age. Granted, Justin's life is a little farther out there than what I think most gay teens would think they would have to come to expect. But at least it shows that there is the possibility of falling in love, being proud of who you are, and then, you know, surviving bad choices.
Yeah. With George and Emmett, I thought it was a cute story, but it was too short. Which maybe that's why I pegged that one in the number two slot, just because we didn't get overwhelmed by it. It left me wanting more and wanting to see more of George and Emmett and what those two could become. So I like that arc, though. What was your number two? Oh.
Well, I didn't really rank them. I just chose them as my favorite. So I didn't really give one a spot over the other. Just ones that I found three that really stood out to
what
me.
Is your second and or third?
So with George, specifically George Circle, and specifically the scene where they go to the opera, because I love nothing more than a stuck-up homophobic, see you next Tuesday, getting put in her place. And so I derived so much pleasure from, one, seeing George being able to be out and proud of who he is with a man that he loves, and then watch the woman who tried to keep him from being who he was.
Virginia Hammond.
Being cut down to size by the young man that loves him.
George and I are having a fabulous time. He's a wonderful companion.
And how did you meet? Are you his hairdresser, decorator, poodle groomer?
Actually, we met on the internet. I whack off on his website.
Yeah, you know what? This champagne is delightful. Isn't
I'm it? The demondick.com.
How fascinating. He must pay you quite handsomely.
Oh, no. No, no. No, he doesn't pay me at all. I wouldn't take it if he did. The reason I'm with George is he gives spectacular head. A skill I'm certain he didn't learn from you.
Yeah, something I liked about it is I didn't see him so much as being out and proud as he was emerging.
Emerging. That's actually a great way to put it. Yes. Much like I would say Justin kind of started to emerge, we saw George get to do that too.
Emmett was definitely out and proud.
That is, yes, that is very true.
And then I like the Granny Faye story. It was a cute little story tucked away in one episode, and the writers kind of blew it later on during the wedding episode because it was just never mentioned again. And that was unfortunate because that was a really, really well-crafted episode.
I'm suddenly in the mood for surf and turf.
You are?
I say we go for the cornucopia door.
It's wildly extravagant. It'll probably land us in the poorhouse.
It's our special day. Besides, Granny Faye and Vera would have wanted us to.
It was an excellent way to serve what could have been with the wedding episode. It almost felt fairy tale-ish, and it worked for me because it was still grounded in this reality, but the allowing Mel and Lindsay to have this discovery together to re-acknowledge what it is that they love about each other and then what that it means that they are able to be more openly in love with each other was a really nice touch and something that I wish the show would go deeper on.
Totally. So for least favorite, I had a tie. Obviously, the wedding.
Yes.
There just wasn't anything to that story. There wasn't any real obstruction to the wedding. It was a terrible wedding itself in Schickel Hall. And that whole episode and Michael buying the gift from Chuck, which is next door to Chad.
Like, really, Michael, are you that dumb?
Yeah, so that whole episode was just a complete boner.
George Sickle saying, oh, I have this hall that you can use if you want.
Go figure.
Really? No one was ever going to mention this? At this point, the listeners might as well go back to the wedding episode because we're just going to start regurgitating all the problems we had with it. But hey.
It's funny because that was one of our shortest episodes that we recorded. But I also thought it was one of the better ones. I don't know if we were just on point there with it. But
I think we were just on fire and had a lot to get out.
We just tore it up.
Which is going to happen. I mean, as we've seen with all of our comments to our followers on Twitter and Facebook, there's clearly still a lot of love for this series. Understanding that...
Fanaticism, well, even.
Sure. Understanding, though, that while there is a lot of love for it, we do have questions. We do have comments. And I think that's what makes our show so fun and interesting to hear as people are revisiting or reminiscing on what they remember from the show.
Yeah, I definitely don't look at the show as a total fanboy. I like some aspects of it, but I also see lots of problems. So I tend to review these episodes with a more open mind than some of the more rabid Brian Justin fans that are out there that think that, you know, Ethan is like the Antichrist.
Ooh, we'll get into when we talk about those polls.
Yeah. What was your least favorite arc?
So I included the wedding episode in this. And you remember how I felt about it when we were talking, not when we were not recording, that party scene with the owner of Babylon with Justin. Yeah. It just, everything about it made me uncomfortable. And I did not, it was very difficult for me to watch the episode and go on that journey. I mean, maybe that is a testament to the way the episode was filmed and performed because I was so uncomfortable during it.
And recording our episode, you almost had to be walked home.
I was just like, I cannot handle this.
I remember that off mic conversation that we had where I was just saying, it's a TV show, Matt. It's not real.
But I think as we see in a lot of warnings today for television series, for film and things like that, we see a lot of trigger warnings and content warnings. We see a lot more of that now. And I feel like an episode like that would have a lot of those kinds of warnings.
Beware. Justin is going to do cocaine, take his shirt off, and kick the sap in the face.
He was also drugged by things not of his own volition. That's the other thing.
Strictly speaking, he spit those drugs out. Remember, took a drink of whatever the liquid was, and he went, but it was the cocaine that he did a great big line of.
I mean, for all we know, that cocaine could have been lined with something, too.
That's true.
So There is a lot of things that maybe he did of his own accord and other things he definitely did not. And it was clear that when they were trying to use him for sex and he was clearly incapacitated to where he could not consent, that was a big problem for me. And the last thing I have... So after...
you took a deep breath. Like,
yes, because I actually really dig the Lita character. I think she's very cool. The thing that I felt like this series did a very did an injustice or disservice to the character was her exit.
Yep.
That's a relief. We were worried you...
First, I renovate your attic, and then I renovate your sex life. And then it's... So long, Lita?
That's not what we meant.
That's how it sounded.
I was not a fan of this, like, sudden petty jealousy that she had and this feeling that she had been taken advantage of when she was no longer invited into Mel and Lindsay's bed. She comes in while they are having relations, just the two of them, and she feels like, oh, well, I figured I'd just jump on in, too.
It's just us girls.
And it's like, no... we're good. And for her to think that, oh, I see, you just wanted to use me to get your attic done and that one time and fine, I'm leaving. And it's like, what?
Out on the sidewalk, she just lays into Melanie.
You find a place? Lucky Lita lands on her feet. Like you give a shit.
As a matter of fact, I do. I feel terrible that...
That you've turned into a proper, dignified, hypocritical bitch?
I just did not... enjoy the fact that that's where we decided to end with the character in this, at least in this season.
It almost seemed like they did a little bit of audience screening there and saw that Lita wasn't testing well, so they just had to exit her from the show really quickly.
Like,
get on your motorbike and leave.
Right out into the sunset.
Literally.
Never to return. It's like, come on.
My other least favorite arc was Michael's father, the drag queen. The arc had some legs, but it wasn't transformative to the story at all. We only once heard reference to it again, and that was just Michael saying, I'm half Italian and half drag queen. That's it. We never hear about this drag king, drag queen father again. In this could have been so much more.
It would have been fascinating to have him appear in Michael's life more.
Yeah,
and maybe Debbie is like, oh, I understand. Yeah, an understanding of that. And they go to a show every once in a while now or something like that. It would have been fascinating to keep going.
Or Debbie is like, Michael, I don't even understand you. Go talk to your father. Yeah, something simple like that.
That would have been fabulous. Yeah. And he has to like go backstage, just like, you know, and I would assume that they would have shown him to be a better drag queen than I think he was in that episode.
Sadly, Gary Beach, who played Danny / Davina DeVore, also known as Michael's father, he died shortly after we released this episode. It was number 13. And it was called It's Because I'm Gay, right? We kind of like that episode, but in the overall scheme of it, the arc was just too short and it was too meaningless to the entire show. So that's why I had to give it my least favorite.
Are you following us on Twitter, Instagram? Check us out at Still Queer AF.
This is Still Queer Spoken. There's more to come. Let's talk about some of the polls that we put out to some of our listeners.
Yes.
So the first one was... George Schickel leaves Emmett $10 million, and Emmett buys expensive gifts for all of his friends, cars, jewelry, trips, the Armani Fall Collection, etc. If you were Emmett's friend, would you accept a gift like that? And the Twitter poll and the Facebook poll were very close together. It was right about 75% hell yeah, 25% not too much. And that really surprised me.
You thought more people were going to be no?
Yeah.
Interesting. This, for me, this tracks.
I don't know if those characters should have felt like they earned that. Should Melanie and Lindsay have really accepted the Subaru? Did they earn that? Or were they just kind of present? I just didn't get that whole event.
I'm sure Emmett, and I think this is apparent later on in this arc, when he basically says, I don't want anything to do with the money because that cheapens what George and I had. While it was really nice for him that he had the money, I could tell he wanted to at least give a nice gesture to his friends, the ones that he has always counted on.
Yeah, I would have thrown a party, though.
Oh, no, I think he also spoke to their needs. Like, he knew what each of them were looking for. Like, he gave Mel and Lindsay something very practical.
They had a motorcycle and a station wagon already. They didn't
I thought he was trying to upgrade the station wagon. Like, you need a more reliable car, so let me get you a Subaru.
Ted didn't need, nor could he not afford, lifetime tickets to the opera.
That's right, because he was not the porn empire king that he is now.
Justin, I can see taking that trip. You know, that's like patronizing the arts.
Sure.
And Justin's a teenager at the time. Brian definitely can afford the Armani Fall collection on his own.
The entire collection?
Michael's gift didn't make sense at all. Like, here's the mortgage on your comic shop. And when we watched that, we were like, mortgage? What mortgage?
That's true. It would have made sense if he had, like, bought a house and he was, like, a little worried because he put everything into the business and didn't know how it was going to work out with the house kind of thing. If that was the situation, sure.
Debbie's tennis bracelet kind of made sense because Debbie had always been sort of a mother figure to Emmett.
She's the charm bracelet to Emmett's life.
Well, Emmett moved to town and really only knew, what was that drag queen's name?
Oh my gosh, I blanked. I know exactly who you're talking about, yeah. Too.
Godiva.
Yes.
So he only knew Godiva when he moved to town and Debbie had known him forever. So, okay, buy your mom a nice tennis bracelet made of diamonds. Great. Okay. But I don't know. It just seemed goofy. The whole thing did. And I was just surprised that so many people would be like that comfortable taking something like that from somebody.
Well, and of all the gifts that he got them, how much of a dent do you think that actually makes in his $10 million?
Well, I don't think that really comes into play, though. I don't think that, or maybe that's exactly the point. If somebody actually considers that, like, well, you have $10 million, what's a $20,000 Subaru to you? Then you're kind of doing exactly what I am accusing all of our listeners of doing. Well, 75%
They did not ask for it, though. He saw a need or an ability to at least give a little something back to his friends, who I'm sure have done this, that, or the other for him. And think of it as gifting them for their kindness.
What
or something.
Melanie and Lindsay really needed was a college trust fund for Gus, not a Subaru.
That's fair. That would have been another option.
Yeah. So the gifts were, I thought, bad. And I don't think anybody should accept gifts from their newly minted multimillionaire friend.
Well, it seems our listeners disagree.
Yeah, I know. Even more so on the next one. The next poll was, the fight for Justin's heart begins. Which team are you on?
Woo!
Twitter had a shocking 94% in favor of Brian and 6% in favor of Ethan. Facebook was a little more generous with 84% Brian and 16% Ethan. I didn't realize exactly the depth of the hatred for Ethan until we engaged with some of our listeners and social media.
There is some, like, hellfire for Ethan.
Yeah, and it extends beyond hellfire to Ethan. It's, like, on us now. Because yes. We're like, this scene's hot, and people are like, how dare you?
And I was thinking about this as I was looking at these numbers, and I think what it is the polls have a sort of a weight against him in that I'm trying to approach, as we revisit the series, like a newcomer. Like, I have never seen the series before. And so when I see how the interactions between Brian and Justin are going, and I see more of a chemistry between Justin and Ethan, I'm more inclined to lean on, I think this Ethan guy is the one who's got it, because Brian clearly doesn't get it, doesn't understand what he has and how good he has it. So I'm rooting for, you know, Justin to have the grander love affair with Ethan, who seems to have, at this point, listeners, at this point, at the end of season two, looks like Ethan is just a better match for Justin. We know that in the series, that's not how things go. But that's why when I see these numbers, I'm thinking, oh, I think our listeners or those who participate have the entire series behind them are thinking, no, Ethan's just a roadblock to what we want. We want our Ross and Rachel moment with Brian and Justin. We all want them to just get back together.
I feel like I respond better to Ethan, kind of the scruffy hipster
bohemian
violin player.
Yes.
Yeah. So I kind of like that character a little bit better. I kind of think he's hotter than Brian too.
Even with the soul patch, I would 1,000% want to get it with Ethan.
So the last poll that we had put out leading up to this one was, should Ted have told Emmett that he's in love with him? This one was somewhat polarizing too. On Facebook, 84% said yes, and 16% said preserve the friendship. Twitter was a little bit more skewed. It was 72% yes and 28% preserve the friendship. This one wasn't nearly as controversial though. I think this really just comes down to personal style and how to follow one's dreams. So this one was just kind of a fun poll that I'd made up really just to see where people were at with that. After the diatribes about Brian and Ethan and Justin.
Here's a little lighthearted one, especially because here we have a friendship that has been forged for the past two seasons that we've seen and has clearly existed before the series began. When do you start to pull that trigger of like, oh, I think I have feelings for this person? The other thing is that with Ted and Emmett, it felt like this, oh, I have feelings for Emmett, kind of came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Just like, huh. Yeah, I'm in love with Emmett, the end. It's like, where'd that come from?
Roll the
from?
Credits.
We'll see you next season.
Yeah. So let's rank some of the actors here. I picked out 1, 2, 3, 4 actors that I wanted to talk about for a minute.
Okay.
So Randy Harrison as Justin is the most believable actor. So much so that I find it really hard to see him as other characters when he's on stage or television. He was just perfectly cast as Justin. And when I just can't see the actor as anybody else, that's when I think that this was really, really a great moment for them in their career. So I really, really like the way that Randy Harrison acts the Justin character.
I want to bring up the mother of them all, Sharon Gless.
Really?
Yes. I think it is... could have been so easy to not lean into the over-the-top nature of Debbie for fear of making her a parody or mocking her in some way. But the fact that Sharon Gless plays Debbie balls to the wall, Liberty balls to the wall, fills me with so much joy because it's all so pure. Like it feels like, yes, she would be the overzealous P-flag mom who's going to always be super proud of her gay son, and no one can ever tear that down from her. It much like how it is with Randy Harrison being so believable and so lived in the Justin character. I feel the same way about Sharon Gless as Debbie.
I like Sharon Gless's acting. I think a lot, well, I'm not going to say a lot. I would say some of the writing for her was not great, and she had to really, really work to turn that into something.
All the more reason why I want to appreciate her acting and what she brought to the role. Because like I said, I think, yeah, someone could have been a little wary about going that far, like the accoutrement she wears.
Yeah.
And being thinking like, oh, do you think it's too much? Sharon Gless is probably like, nah, we need more shit on you. Keep it going. Keep it going. Like, I love that she just goes there with it.
So my second favorite actor is Scott Wall. Ted is such a wide character, and he just gets even wider and wider in season 3 and 4. And Scott Wall just effortlessly plays all these different facets of Ted. I think this role was really, really well written. And I think that he was able to act it in a way that really, really made me believe in Ted. There weren't too many situations in season 1 or 2 where I thought that Scott Lowell was really dropping the ball with the Ted character. And I like that. Just about every other character, I could find something where I thought they either acted it poorly or they just came across as fake.
So I want to continue on this conversation with Scott Lowell, because Ted is, as I mentioned in the series, one of my favorite characters, if not my favorite character in the series. And so, and I know things aren't going to go well for him coming down the road. But I just love Ted because I think what Scott Lowell does with him is maybe in the same approach that Sharon Gless does with Debbie, is that he lives in the neuroses so well and just embraces it wholeheartedly. And says like, he's going to be wacky. He's going to be so unsure of himself. And like, he'd be the, and then of course he'd be the kind of person who's watching porn at work. Cause that's his one escape from the dread of everyday 9-to-5 life. And I just, yeah, I think Scott Lowell found a way to sort of be the every gay man, I think is how to say,
yeah,
of the series. A character that could have been so bland on the page compared to some of our other characters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he is not flashy. He's not outlandish. He finds a way to somewhat be grounded in this world. I think that's a tribute to what Scott Lowell does with it.
My third actor was Gale Harold. He's a decent actor, but he was pretty early in his career at the time. But the writing sometimes gets in the way of his performance, and he sometimes comes off as a bit awkward. But when he's on and the writing's on with him, Gale Harold can really make me believe in this kind of fictional yet desirable Brian Kinney character. And I really like that, especially compared to Stuart Alan Jones in the UK version. That was a little more of a stretch for me, but Gale Harold really portrayed a character that I think I knew at many places in my life, even as a composite character. So he gets my number three rank here.
And I like to bring up our lovable Emmett Peter Page.
Yes.
Good. I'm glad we want to talk about him. Because something that I think has gone back and forth in the depiction of gay men in the past 20 years, let's go with that, is the femme character. You know, on one hand, I believe in one hand, there's a reluctance to play the femme character because we believe it's stereotyping the gay man. On the other hand, there are femme gay men out there, and they should be depicted just as much as any other gay man that exists out there. Not all gay men are built alike. And I love that Peter Page wholeheartedly just loves what Emmett is giving out to the world. And it's so wonderfully lovable. And I think that's also attributed to what Peter Page brings to Emmett. And owning every little swish, every little snap, every costume that he has to wear in this series. It's just, this is Emmett, and that's okay. And if you have a problem with that, I'll kick your ass, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I look at Emmett in the context of the show versus today, he doesn't seem that femme.
That's
fair. Compared to a lot of the people we know.
Because now I believe queer people are able to further embrace either their femininity or masculinity or neither. Mm-hmm. And it's so awesome to watch. I was in New York back in July, and I saw this musical that I have been obsessed with. And I am telling every person that who I know live in New York or go to visit New York, I say, go and see it. It's a musical called Head Over Heels, which is a musical based off of this 16th century novel, and it's set to the music of the Go-Go's. And it is just incredible, because what you don't quite realize until the show starts is that they are fully living for everybody on the queer spectrum in this wackadoo musical. And you have this oracle named Pythio, who's played by the first transgender woman to create a role on Broadway, Peppermint, who was on season 9 of Drag Race, comes down and literally lays down the law of no gender here. And it was such an exciting, invigorating moment to see on a Broadway stage that I think you can attribute a little bit of that to the way I think Peter Page portrays such an outwardly femme character, someone who was okay with that in their body. Yes, in the first season, he had to sort some of that out through a cult. But now embracing it and getting to see that on television, where it is not mocked and he is able to stand up for himself without any issue at all. Rocks my world. Go Peter Page.
I left him off my ranking because I knew that you were going to do at least 5 minutes on him.
You do? So. I got more. I got more notes.
So my last one is Jack Weatherall. As Uncle Vic, he's just consistently on point. And for such a minor role, Jack Weatherall really brings Uncle Vic to life every time. There's never a weak scene from him. Some of the writing, like we've talked about before, is a little bit hokey. I remember in season one, he was just about one foot into the grave. Yeah. He's dragging himself around. He only wore sweatsuits and things like that.
Bathrobes and all this. Yeah.
End of season two, he's out at Babylon dancing. And so Jack Weatherall carrying that character through two seasons. And it's a minor character, but he was just very consistent in his delivery. And I like the way that he and Sharon Gless worked together because they would often take some pretty mediocre lines in a mediocre scene and just make it sparkle.
How long has it been since you went on a date?
How the fuck do I know?
1992.
Must be so rusty it squeaks.
Their energy off of each other is just fantastic.
So there's another moment that I wanted to talk about in this recap episode that we're doing, and I call this a retroactive continuity moment.
Okay.
And this is something that I picked up from the West Wing Weekly, which is where something in present day happens that kind of contradicts something in the past. And so they retroactively build in continuity to it.
Okay.
So let's talk about when Ben first comes onto the scene. And as you recall, Michael brings him into Babylon, introduces him to the guys.
Looks, brains. Nice guy, too. I'd say he's perfect, except for one thing. He's positive.
So, at that point, we learn a few episodes later that Ben had been positive for 5 years. However, Brian fucked Ben at the White Party 2 years ago. Brian didn't know that Ben was positive until he found out from Tet at Babylon when Ben first meets everyone. So, at the time, Brian showed no inkling of knowing who Ben was or anything, which could be explained away by the sheer volume of Brian's tricking. But apparently, Ben never disclosed his status to Brian before Brian tied him up and fucked him.
Yeah. I'm trying to replay those moments when Ted was being an asshole about Ben's status. Now, granted, at the White Party, they got into some king play. We know for sure that they fucked. It wasn't just some like...
Yeah, because later on, Ben is telling Michael the story when they're in bed, and he talks about how...
Yes, okay.
Yeah, Brian had got off, but Ben didn't.
Right.
And so Brian kept fucking him until Ben got off, and then Brian got off at the same time. So this was interesting because the timing is such that somebody like Ben, and in fact anybody, really should have disclosed that.
In those five...
And he was one of the most ardent ones to Michael, like, get away from him.
In those 5 years, because we know that Ben has sort of gone through a, let's say, religious transformation with his Buddhism. Could that have happened after the fact? Could it have been something where... Great, yes,
that
he should
first have... was positive?
No, and that he hadn't disclosed his status yet, and then he learned...
He learned how to.
He learned how to.
So that kind of makes him a bad guy then.
Exactly. Yes.
A flawed.
Because again,
flawed individual.
Yeah, a flawed individual. In the sense that, yes, because that is still such a, there's such a stigma that people believe that means something bad about the person who is positive. And it's the furthest thing from the case. Like, if anything, you can trust people who are positive more than you can trust people who don't know their status. So it is an interesting hole that we're trying to fill.
Yeah.
In a manner of speaking.
Retroactive continuity.
Yes. Because we've had questions about Ben's status before, like a lot of questions about how this storyline should work out and how it should pan out.
Yeah. This, if anything, this was just some sloppy writing by different writers that didn't have good continuity throughout the entire season,
because
the seasonal arc or the character's arc.
Right, because when it's revealed that they had hooked up before, it was as if it was new to Brian too, that, oh, this was just new information. He just
Yeah.
Recently figured out. I was like, really?
Yeah, Brian didn't even recognize him at first.
I mean, let's be honest. Like, I know Brian fucks a lot of people, yeah, but I would have remembered
exactly.
This. I would have remembered the guy tied up during the white party and fucked so senselessly.
That's
that
built like Paul Bunyan.
Come on. Please.
This is still Queer as Folk, and we'll be right back.
We hope you're loving the episode, and why don't you show us that love with 5 stars on Apple Podcasts.
So let's talk a little bit about a reunion. While we were recording season two, Entertainment Weekly had put together a cast reunion. And coming out of it, there was a lot of fan interest in a revival or a reboot of the show with the same cast. And I just have to say I'm not in favor of that. I'm not in favor of a revival with the same cast. I feel like every story that needed to be told about the characters has already happened. You know, you see like some of these shows that go on forever, and eventually you've done so much to the characters that you can't possibly do any more to them. That's why Degrassi worked so well for like 15 years. The kids graduated, they aged off the show.
And we got new kids.
Yeah. Yeah. So they didn't do it in a way like the whole class didn't disappear. They always had like freshmen through seniors. So like the seniors go away, the underclassmen start to take on the more important storylines. And that's why the show had such really, really long legs to it. I just don't know what you can do with these characters at their age now. So like Gerald Harold is 48, 49. Randy Harrison is 40, 41. What does this show become then with those characters?
Yes. Yeah, so this becomes the whole question of reunion the way Will and Grace was put together, to say that it's just a continuation of the series of the same characters that we've seen. And we get all nostalgic about seeing these same characters in similar wacky situations. Or there's the route of reboot, where you take, yes, this is Queer as Folk, but you acknowledge that the world has changed since then, and we should comment on that the way I would say the reboot of One Day at a Time does, where it could have continued to follow a white single mom I'm not sure where the original one took place, but now you see it using people who exist today. You have a Cuban single mom who is a war vet and has to deal with things like her daughter's friend's immigration status and having to deal with her PTSD from being over in Afghanistan, like things like that, that make it, yes, it's the same title and it's the same overall structure, but it makes it a hell of a lot more interesting and relevant today.
Yeah.
Rita Moreno.
I've got a couple thoughts on reboots also. With these characters, I liked where the show ended, and I've never once thought about what the characters might have turned into. I just liked where they ended. I liked that it's really in keeping with Brian's mantra of being forever young and never outgrowing yourself. And in that way, I like just having the snapshot in time. If you look at people in your own life that were like critically important to you 15 years ago, and then you run into them now or look them up, you're kind of like, whoa, what happened to you? And you have nothing in common with them anymore, other than like maybe a passing curiosity at like, boy, you didn't age well, something like that. So I'm just not sure what more these characters have to say to me. I think they've said it all. Mm-hmm. I think it's a perfect snapshot in a scrapbook in time. I don't really want to see these characters start the show again. Now, a reboot, though, is slightly more interesting to me. My only fear would be, though, that goes to what you're talking about, is that it turns the show into like every other gay show that's ever been made. This show was pretty unique. What made it unique was it didn't take place in the summer in little skimpy swimsuits.
Mm-hmm.
It was not that kind of a gay show. Today, if you were to have a gay or queer show, you gotta get the clothes off these characters like all the time. The only time the clothing really came off of the characters in Queer as Folk is when they're gonna have sex.
When it's supposed to come off.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, sometimes. Sometimes they're just bending people over in the bathroom stall at work, you know.
But still, if you think about, okay, what would Queer as Folk be now? It would be taking place on the beach all the time. And that's what I really liked about Queer as Folk, is that it wasn't at all what you'd expect from a gay show in 2018. It's very, not so much period, but it's just something that I found more relatable. I don't know. I can't stand like Queer Eye and Drag Race. I just don't connect with any of those characters the same way that shows like Looking I would connect with, or Eyewitness, or even the gay characters on Degrassi, even though they're like in high school. I relate to that because they're not running around in their underwear for no apparent reason other than to try to get ratings.
Quick note. Have you seen like the new Queer Eye?
Yes.
Okay. I'm sad that you have that opinion because I actually really enjoy it. But like I said, I think if we were to do one of those continuation of this series with the same characters, it would be a very difficult show for me to digest, considering that it follows a predominantly white gay male who live privileged lives.
You know, not all of them.
I mean, their problems are a lot less severe.
Through
a 2018 lens is what I'm talking about. Through a 2018
prison's
lens.
Still valid, right? Michael worked retail.
Yeah.
Melanie was a lawyer that apparently never had any money.
Right, and spoke all access powers. But right. in comparison to other lives, the rather privileged lives, like they all have a roof over their head, they all have jobs, like their complaints are who they're going to fuck at the bar the next weekend. Whereas I feel like a show, like you said, like Looking, I thought did an excellent job of speaking to contemporary gay life and was a rather worthy successor of Queer as Folk. And I know, I think of people who had issues with Looking, but they thought it was too quiet I was sitting there watching Looking and seeing like, these are the exact conversations I'm having with my friends today. And that's how I was connecting with it. And the fact that you had characters of color like Augustine and Richie showing up in this series and it was acknowledged like that is who they were, was a really beautiful thing. And I thought Looking deserved a much fairer shot than it got. And I mean, I particularly loved the Looking movie that wrapped all the storylines up.
Yeah, so I don't think Looking really took off because it didn't have enough screaming.
Have enough of the more explicit sex scenes that I think Queer as Folk had in its earlier seasons. I think people were expecting that. Like, if you're going to show this gay live show at all, and it's like, I felt like I got quite a.
Yeah, as soon as Russell Tovey took his pants off, we were like, we did scream.
Let's talk about when Richie rims Patrick. I have a gif of that saved, believe me. I mean, that was
the first scene of Queer as Folk, too, by the way.
But here, the rimming scene in Looking was very different from the rimming scene here. Because I feel like in Queer as Folk, we get the reaction of when...
Right.
But here, in Looking, we got not only the moment when Patrick's legs go up in the air and we know what Richie is getting in there, but then there's also the moment of Richie who is blowing Patrick to the point where he does come, and we see this like whole action happening right before us.
Well, yeah, I mean, one had a different level of tenderness and taste to it, and this one had a different level of vulgarity.
Sure, yeah.
For a very specific reason. So, yes, it was two different styles of shooting and two different scripts, but I don't know, is that Queer as Folk being shot on film? And,
Yeah, I know. I should probably stop, because then I'm just going to turn this into like a Stan account of Looking.
Yeah, that'll be the next podcast.
Yeah. Oh, I would be very much into that.
So that's our thoughts on season two. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with the debut episode of season three. In the meantime, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us, and subscribe. It really means a lot to us and it helps more people find our show.
We're on Twitter and Instagram at StillQueerAF. You can also like us on Facebook at StillQueerAsFolk.
If you want to connect with us personally And I hope you do. You can find me on Instagram at Patrick Randall, no E's.
And you can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Matthew PD.
Thanks again for joining us. I'm Patrick Randall.
And I'm Matt Dominguez.
We'll see you in a couple weeks. Still, Queer as Folk was written and performed by Patrick Randall and Matt Dominguez.
New episodes every Wednesday as we take apart the show one episode at a time.
Available now on iTunes,
Google Play,
Stitcher,
TuneIn,
Overcast,
Pocket Cast, and all your other favorite podcatchers.
Still, Queer as Folk is made with love in Chicago.